Session number 9822, Reel 1.
Commander Fraser, Reel 1. How did you come to join the Navy, Commander Fraser?
Well, going back to 1938, I was on a ship that was an old wooden wall called HMS Conway, which was moored in the Mersey, which was a training ship for the Merchant Navy. And I did 2 years on that, and then I joined Blue Star Line as a cadet. And at the same time, I became a midshipman in the Royal Naval Reserve. In June 1939, I applied to the Navy to allow me to do my 4 months training as a midshipman. I had to do 4 months training in the Navy. And they took me in, and I joined a battleship called the Royal Oak in June 1939 for the fleet review at Weymouth. And then, of course, the war broke out in September, and I stayed in the Navy for the rest of the war.
What was it like aboard the Royal Oak?
Well, it was quite different to being on board a merchant ship, of course. I mean, she was a mighty battleship of the First World War with, 8 16-inch guns or more. And it was... I was quite happy there because I'd been on the Conway and I had a certain amount of knowledge of seamanship. I was made coxswain of the picket boat, which is the boat that they use mainly for running officers ashore, but a steam picket boat. And running into Weymouth without all the popsies sitting on the quay, I quite enjoyed that as a 19 and 18 year old.
Was it a happy ship to sail aboard?
Well, I don't remember. I was only on it a fortnight. just over a fortnight, and just after the fleet review, I was transferred to a destroyer called the Kent, HMS Kent, and I was only on that for 6 weeks before I was transferred again to another destroyer called HMS Montrose.
Did you see any action aboard the Montrose?
Oh yes, quite a lot on the Montrose. First of all, we went to Dunkirk in, was it May 1940?
Yes.
And we spent several days running backwards and forwards to France, carrying troops back to England. Eventually we hit a tug on the way back in a fog, and they put the Montrose out of action, and she was taken for a refit at Chatham Dockyard. Of course, I was transferred again then to another destroyer.
How many times did you go across to Dunkirk on the Montrose?
Well, of course, every day we went across two or three times over a 24-hour period. I must have done about 10 trips, I suppose.
What picture did the beaches present?
Oh, they were a terrible sight. I mean, it was the time when all the soldiers were struggling to get down the beaches, were being dive bombed by Stukas, these German dive bombers. There were aerial fights going on, and we only had one casualty, as I remember. We had one chap who got a bullet in his backside on the way back on one of the trips, but that was the only casualty we had, as far as I remember.
Was the Montrose specifically attacked by air?
Oh yes, she was dive bombed on two or three of the occasions that we went across there.
But none of the bombs came near?
Oh no, nothing even splashed us, I don't think. They were all a good way away. Well, of course, we were doing something like 20 knots backwards and forwards, or 25 knots. We certainly weren't going slow.
Can you describe what it was like under dive bomb attack?
Well, you know, when you're a young man, as I was then, 19 years old, it didn't worry me very much. I found it all rather exciting. I certainly was never felt frightened anyway. But I presume it couldn't have been a very pleasant thing, really. It didn't worry me very much.
Were the pilots really brave to have done that?
Stuka pilots?
Yes.
Oh, God, no. They had almost complete mastery of the skies. Very few fighters out against them, and they were just doing what they wanted to do. It's just they weren't very accurate.
What condition were the troops in whom you took aboard?
Well, I should say they were... What were they? They were depressed. They were shattered. But they weren't a beaten army. At least they didn't seem like a beaten army. They just wanted to get back and start again, from what I remember.
Were they just British troops, or did you take any others?
I think... We're going back to 1940. I don't remember taking any foreigners, although I suppose we must have picked up a few. But I certainly don't remember any masses of foreign soldiers.
Were you going in alongside the mole?
Yeah, alongside the mole, yes. Alongside the jetty.
Were you able to do anything for the troops once they're on board, to feed them, or were they...
Well,
just...
it was a question of feeding them, but we gave them sort of cups of tea and coffee and soup and that sort of thing. But of course it was only a half hour, 40-minute trip back across the channel again for us into Dover.
What other action did you see aboard Montrose?
That was about all on Montrose. She had this accident, and I was then transferred to Malcolm. I don't know, looking at my thing, is that right? Like, I've got,
yes.
Montrose and then Malcolm, have I? That's right, yes. Malcolm was the one that I spent most time on.
What kind of ship was Malcolm?
Well, she was a destroyer. She was exactly the same type as the Montrose. They were both what they call flotilla leaders. They were slightly bigger than the ordinary destroyers, but they were built to lead the what were in those days were called the V and W class destroyers.
What particular work stands out in your mind about the Malcolm?
Well, the Malcolm, I had quite a varied career on her. I'm talking about the actions we were in more than anything else. We went to Harwich. We were based on Harwich to start with. And from Harwich, we used to go across at night to the Texel and the Kattegat and carry out night attacks on enemy shipping, sometimes convoys, sometimes just on single ships. And that was most exciting, speeding across there at full speed. All ensigns flying, and then suddenly switching on the lights, the searchlights, picking up a ship and firing our guns at it, switching off the searchlights, and then going looking for another one. We must have done that on two or three times, I think, during the time I was on that ship.
What kind of opposition did you come across?
Oh, none at all from enemy shipping, from enemy warships. They're mostly sort of little merchant ships we were bombarding.
So they were unescorted convoys, weren't they?
Yeah, little unescorted convoys running up and down the Kattegat.
What type of things were they carrying, do you know?
Oh, that I don't know. No, I have no idea. No idea. They may have been only little passenger ships. I really don't know what they were.
Would they have guns on the merchant ships?
No. None of them had guns. We eventually got... we were the first destroyer, or first ship probably, one of the first ships in the Navy, to be fitted with radar. They put this damn great aerial thing up on the top of the foremast, and we were from then onwards we were able to go into the Skagerrak and the Kattegat with the and the Texel with the and we were able to see the ships on the radar screen, so they never knew we were coming, and we'd get within probably 500 yards of them and then switch the searchlights on and bombard them.
Were any of them taken as prizes?
No, none at all. We couldn't have taken them as prizes. I think probably that area of water was probably full of enemy warships. It was just that we never seemed to come across them. But I think if we'd tried to take a prize and bring it back, we'd have run into real trouble.
Oh, you never took captives or anything of that kind?
No, nothing like that. Not that I can remember, anyway.
Did you pick survivors up?
No. We just did our job and then shot out again. And we were only there, each time we went there, we were only there a very short space of time, I don't know, an hour, couple of hours, no longer, and then back to the UK again.
And I think you're also on convoy duty on the Malcolm as well.
Yes, she was then she was Malcolm was transferred to Milford Haven. And we ran convoy duties on the North Atlantic convoys from Milford Haven for a while. I don't know how long, because it depends on the record of the time I was in that ship. But eventually we went up to Reykjavik, in Iceland. And we were escorting convoys, picking them up as they came across the Atlantic and picking them up in Iceland, or just south of Iceland, escorting them to UK territorial waters, then breaking off and going into Londonderry before we went out again on another convoy. Then we went back to Iceland again. And in actual fact, I was in Iceland when the... was it the Bismarck or the Tirpitz? When the Tirpitz attacked the Hood and the Prince of Wales, and actually sank the Hood. And on that occasion,
this was the Bismarck, I think.
Was it the Bismarck?
Bismarck and Prince Eugen.
Oh, the Bismarck. That's right. Yes. No, no, was it? Yes, the Bismarck. It was the Bismarck. And we were sent out as a. There were, I think, there were three destroyers there. We were the flotilla leader, and we had two other destroyers. And we were sent out to attack the Bismarck from Reykjavik. And I remember that very well because we went absolutely flat out, full speed. All the boilers burned up, smoke pouring from the funnel, all our battle ensigns hoisted, and that's the most exciting thing of a wartime action in a destroyer-type vessel, having all these huge white ensigns hung up all over the place, streaming out in the wind as you belt along at 30-odd knots. We never actually caught up with them, thank God. But we did arrive on the spot where the Hood had been sunk, because we picked up a few bits and pieces, life belts, the odd sailors' hats, and things like that, just to mark the spot.
But none of the few survivors?
No, any survivors that had been had already been picked up by somebody else who'd been there before us. We were then ordered back to Reykjavik, and that was the end of that little episode.
Was the Hood wreckage spread over a huge area?
By the time we got there, yes. And don't ask me how long it was after it was sunk. It must have been, I don't know, 20 hours, 30 hours afterwards, I would have thought.
What exactly are the battle ensigns?
Oh, they're just white ensigns. But basically, when you go into battle, you hoist the largest white ensign you've got on board up on the yardarm at the foremast. And you've got another one streaming out on the flagpole at the stern of the ship.
But not normally, did you not fly the white ensign?
Well, not at sea, no. Not at sea. It was hoisted once you were in harbour and tied up alongside.
Why was that? Why didn't you have it flying at sea?
Oh, it's just not customary to fly. No ship that I know of, even a merchant ship, flies a flag at sea. They only fly them in harbour.
Any other work that you did aboard Malcolm that we can recollect?
No, I think, let me think, no, what did I do next? The next thing we were doing, we were running convoys from Londonderry, and of course I saw a lot of action against U-boats in the North Atlantic on the convoys we escorted, and we did in fact sink one. I have, the number of it is on record at the records office at Kew. I forgot the number, U651 or something. And we took prisoners of war from that U-boat.
Can you describe that incident in detail?
No, not really. Obviously it was a depth charge attack by ourselves and other destroyers, and obviously the submarine eventually surfaced and the crew all jumped over the side. But I remember them, we threw over the landing nets for them to scramble on board the destroyer, and the captain actually put them all down the after locker on the destroyer, which was a very uncomfortable place, right down the stern of the ship, and he stuck them down there and left them down there because I think he got a bit upset because the captain of the submarine was taken up onto the bridge and stood there and gave him a Nazi salute, and he told him to get the hell off the bridge. And then that was that.
What was the attitude towards the U-boat crews? Were they hated or respected or what?
They were respected. I don't think anybody hated them. I think they were respected. They were just a damn nuisance, though. I mean, we picked up quite an... On various convoys, I don't know any particular one, but on various convoys we picked up a considerable number of survivors from British merchant shipping that had been sunk. And I remember there's... As a midshipman, I was put down. One of them was so badly burnt off a tanker that he was put in the captain's bunk, in the captain's cabin below. And as a midshipman, I stayed with him most of the time to try and help him. Well, I can't remember what happened to him, whether he died or whether we got him back. I just don't remember, but I do remember being down in that cabin with him for quite a long time.
Was he getting any treatment?
Oh, he's getting the best treatment we could give him on board, but of course we didn't have any doctors on board. We had a sick berth attendant. That was a sort of male nurse, really.
What was the demeanour of the U-boat crew, apart from the captain who gave the Nazi salute?
Oh, they were still quite cocky. Obviously, the war was over, and I think they were quite happy to be cocky. You know, I think they were glad to get away from it all, because life in British submarines wasn't all that good. But sure, it was a hell of a sight worse in German submarines, in the U-boats.
Why was that?
Well, I don't know if you saw that film on television about the U-boat. I thought that was very true to life of British submarines, but it was a lot more uncomfortable. And they say they stayed at sea for so long. I mean, our average patrol in a British submarine was 3 weeks, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. But these guys were out at sea for months on end in those tiny little U-boats.
Was that U-boat sinking before or after the Bismarck chase? Do you remember?
I would think it was after. I can't really remember, but I should think it was after, yeah.
So sometime in the summer of 41?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you describe what an Atlantic convoy was like?
What was it like? Well, not really. I mean, I wouldn't know how to describe it. It was just a mass of ships, perhaps 100 ships, all spread out in line ahead and line abreast in a sort of a big square almost, all going at the speed of the slowest ship, because that was the speed of the convoy, which is usually about 7 knots. And it would have a couple of destroyers ahead, zigzagging. The whole convoy would be zigzagging. But the destroyers, to a fixed pattern, we had zigzag books, which the zigzags were numbered 1 to 200 or whatever that number of zigzags there were, and the commodore would say follow zigzag pattern number 5, and all the ships at a certain time would all do a 20 degree starboard ahead, 20 degree port, this sort of thing. And ahead of them they'd have perhaps a couple of destroyers zigzagging on their own with their Aztecs looking for trying to pick up submarines, and on either side they'd have corvettes or perhaps other destroyers all doing the same thing, and all, of course, all the merchant ships would be trying not to make smoke, to give themselves away. But it was a bore, actually. It was an absolute bore, convoy duty. You just sat there for day after day after day, and occasionally you got picked up something on the Aztec which might possibly be a submarine, and you all started depth charging and carrying out attacks on it. But generally speaking, convoy work was really boring.
Did you look forward to something appearing on the Aztec screen?
Oh, yes. Anything to take away the monotony. In fact, my mind used to boggle at those people, the Aztec operators, because they'd sit in that little tiny cabin up on the bridge with a pair of headphones on, listening to this ping, ping, ping for hours on end. I don't know how they didn't go balmy.
You've talked about these zigzag books, but didn't that make your zigzags predictable to an experienced U-boat captain?
No, not really. They. Well, I suppose if he could have watched, if he saw a ship doing something and he watched it for an hour, because it probably took an hour to do a complete zigzag, you see. You'd go on a course for 10 minutes, then you'd alter course 20 degrees to port for 10 minutes, then 10 degrees to starboard for 15 minutes, and 5 degrees to port for 5 minutes, and this sort of thing, you see, and everybody'd all do it together. But of course, they didn't have to be predictable. I mean, the convoys were such a massive thing that the submarines used to hunt in packs, as you know, in wolf packs. And they just used to surface at night, look at the convoy and fire all their fish. They didn't even have to aim the things, I shouldn't think. It was such a massive, they're bound to hit something.
So they used to fire the torpedoes on the surface?
At night, yes. There were day attacks, of course, as well, but the wolf packs used to mainly attack at night.
So this was the time when you applied to go on submarines yourself, was it?
Well, eventually I got a bit bored with doing this. I couldn't see much future in it. So I volunteered for the submarine service, yes.
What qualifications did they demand of you for the submarine service?
None at all. I was eventually accepted. I think there must have been a shortage of submarine officers. I was eventually accepted, and I went to HMS Elphin, which is a Blythe in Northumberland, and did a submarine training course which lasted 6 weeks. There was a test or examination of some sort at the end of that, which I presumably passed. I don't remember taking it, but I must have passed it. And then I found myself in submarines.
Can you remember any highlights of the training for submarines?
Of the training? No, not really. All I can remember was there was a cinema in Blythe, which was called the Roxy, and somebody, and it was lit up at night. It wasn't lit up at night because of the blackout, but somebody had broken off the bottom arm of the R, so instead of being called Roxy, it was called something else. But that's about all I can remember of the submarine training. Oh, I remember going to sea on our sea training there. We went out in really ancient submarines for sea training. They were called the L class, and they were real leftovers from the 1418 war. That's about all I remember of that.
What was your first ship? First submarine?
My first submarine. Well, after the training class, I was sent to Dundee, a spare crew. In other words, if a submarine needed a crew, they went to the spare crew and took somebody of the right rank. And I mean, because you had all sorts of ranks, and from able seaman right up to a spare CO there. So if anybody was taken sick and they needed somebody, so I went to spare crew to the 9th Submarine Flotilla, which is based at Dundee. And I did a patrol as spare crew in a U-class submarine. I can't remember the name of it, but we went up off the North Cape somewhere for 18 days, and that was my first submarine patrol. And then my first appointment to a submarine was to a submarine, to an old 1914-18 war submarine called the H-28. And these submarines were used for what we call ASDIC running, to give the destroyers and the corvettes exercises in how to use their ASDIC and to carry out attacks on submarines. We had these old boats, and we were based in various places, Campbelltown in Mulligan Tower there, and Londonderry, and various other places. And you go out at some ungodly hour of the morning, 7:30, and you spend all day at sea with the destroyers and the corvettes carrying out dummy attacks on you from the surface. And that's what I did for quite a long time. And from H-28, that was called H-28, that boat, I was transferred to another submarine called H-43, which is exactly the same type of thing, and doing exactly the same time of work. And eventually, after presumably they thought I got enough experience, as with everybody else, I was then appointed to a submarine which was just finishing building at Camelairds. In those days, they didn't have names. They were just known by their number, their naval number. And so I was known, the submarine I was sent to was called P212. She was a 750-ton S-class submarine. Her captain was a fellow called John Bromage, Lieutenant John Bromage. And I stood by at Camelairds, this thing finishing off building, for about a month. And then we commissioned. We went out and did our trials in Liverpool Bay. And we very nearly had the same accident as the Thetis did. I don't know if you remember that, but we went out to Liverpool Bay to do our trials, and we did our first dive. Took about a bow-down angle of about 20 degrees, went straight into the mud on the bottom of Liverpool Bay and got stuck there. And eventually, by blowing tanks and full astern and full ahead and all this sort of thing, eventually we broke loose and surfaced again. And when we came back into harbour and they checked up for what had happened, we found that the A trimming tank, that's the most forward tank in the boat, there'd been a nail or something caught in the Kingston valve in the bottom, which had made a ridge in it, and overnight some tons of water had got into this tank and made it extra heavy.
Did you have any radio or wireless to...
No, we had nothing to communicate with the surface then, and we had a lot of the dockyard mateys on board as well, the people from Camelairs, because we were carrying out trials, and it could have been a nasty thing, but it turned out all right in the end, and we all got back.
So it's entirely up to you to free yourselves?
Yes, yeah. Yeah. But of course the Thetis was an even worse thing, because they had so much water in, they couldn't free themselves, but we only had the water in this one particular tank, which was rather lucky.
Which year was that, that you had that accident?
Yeah. When did I join SAIB? I joined SAIB on the 1st of April 1942. So it must have been about sometime in May 42.
How do you spell SAIB?
SAHIB. Pucker SAIB. Yeah.
And so P212 became the SAIB?
Then became the SAIB, yes.
Did you take part in any operations in P212?
Yes, I think I took part, from my own records, in about 11 different operations. Unfortunately, we weren't allowed to keep diaries during the war, as you know, and it was very very difficult to commit things like this. You couldn't commit them to paper, and it's very difficult to commit them to memory, and I certainly can't remember what we did on 11 different submarine operations, each one lasting, what, 2 or 3 weeks. But first of all, we did a North Cape covering a Russian convoy when we first commissioned. And where did we do that from? Well, we must have sailed from Dundee or somewhere like that, I should think. And then we sailed to the Mediterranean, and we went to Gibraltar, and we did two patrols from Gibraltar, and then we went to Malta and joined up with the 10th Submarine Patrol in Malta. Where we were for quite a considerable time.
On the Russian convoy trips, what kind of covering role did a submarine have to do?
Really, looking for other submarines, looking for U-boats. The U-boats used to tank along on the surface quite a lot. They were quite fast, you see. They could do about 17 knots, whereas the average British submarine did about 12 knots. So they were faster than a lot of corvettes and things that we had to chase them. And we used to stay dived all day, keeping a periscope watch. And, of course, the days were very long in May 1942, up in the way up north there. I mean, they lasted 24 hours, practically. We saw one U-boat. I know this because I was talking to them when I went to this reunion the other day. I was talking to him, and he reminded me of it. And we actually fired 6 fish at it. But missed. It was a long way away. It was about 6,000 to 7,000 yards away. And really, that's what we're there for, to provide. All for enemy shipping, of course. If the Scharnhorst or the Gneisenau or any of these things had come out of German ports or French ports or Norwegian ports to attack convoys, we were there to sort of protect them against those as well.
So you drove that U-boat off, did you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether the U-boat actually saw the torpedoes or not, but it just disappeared then.
It must be extraordinarily difficult to hit another submarine with a torpedo, is it?
Well, it depends how far away it is, of course. But quite a lot of them were hit by our end. I mean, when I was inside, we sank a U-boat. It was on the surface going in the Mediterranean, going from somewhere to somewhere, keeping a nice steady course. And I can't remember the range, but we were 3,000 or 4,000 yards away, and the captain fired all his fish at it, six torpedoes, and hit it.
Where was this, off Malta?
I can't remember. It was in the Mediterranean somewhere. Again, you see, I couldn't keep records. I couldn't keep a diary. So I could find out. The easiest way for me to find out would be to go to the Admiralty, to the records office at Kew, where I could probably find out when this happened. But we surfaced on that occasion immediately after we heard the thing blow up, and went in on the surface to have a look at it. And I was the navigator on SAIB. And I was on the bridge with the captain, and we saw the wreckage, and we saw a couple of dead bodies in the water. We didn't try to pick them up or anything.
And that was in 1942 as well, was it?
Was that in 42 or 43?